Hi, this is John Hockenberry, and speaking to someone who clearly loves to listen at the time of their choosing, you should give the WNYC app a try, you know? Not only can you listen to this program, but it'll also automatically search for the kinds of stories and subjects you like. It's really cool, and it's free. There are other apps and radio stations available, but thanks for listening. Here's today's program. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. The tales from pictures and witnesses from a now quiet field of tragedy in eastern Ukraine. A pink children's book, a parking ticket, an Asian travel guide lying in the mud, a book of stickers, children's playing cards near a road, Nivea skin cream no longer connected to a real person's skin, a razor lying randomly separated from the face it was purchased to groom, white slippers, bottle of cologne, blue blanket in a red suitcase impaled on a metal pole, a bicycle lying in the grass. All details from the New York Times and other news reports and pictures of the crash site of Malaysian Flight 17, the plane brought down yesterday apparently by an advanced surface-to-air missile. War and its consequences, seen and unforeseen this hour. That's how the big stories in the world line up without a lot of prompting on our part. You'll see what I mean as we also follow the situation in Gaza, a surprising story out of Afghanistan. We'll talk about a legal step forward for some inmates at the Guantanamo Detention Center. But we begin this hour with the latest in the Malaysian airline tragedy, Flight 17 from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur, that region where the plane came down, eastern Ukraine, in the middle of its own separatist conflict being conducted on land, sea, and air. It is a war zone. We go now to Kiev and Andriy Kulyakov, Public Radio Ukraine correspondent.
Well, the feeling of shock is still overwhelming. No one, I would say, expected this thing to happen. And of course, the bits of information that we gather from public sources are not enough to put together a eloquent picture. But I was at the briefing given by the State Security Service, and he made public some details that, from the Ukrainian point of view, prove that it was not the Ukrainian armed forces that shot down the jet. There is also some information that says now that the anti-aircraft missile complex that may have shot down the plane is being transported back to Russia.
Interesting. Does Ukraine have any kind of capability equivalent to the Buk missile, which people are talking about as the possible culprit here, the long-range surface-to-air missile that may have shot down this plane?
Ukraine admits that Ukrainian armed forces had these missiles, but all of them are on the territory that is being temporarily controlled by the militants. So the Ukrainian official viewpoint is that the Ukrainian armed forces do not possess this kind of weapon at the moment, and they did not possess this kind of weapon yesterday when the tragedy happened.
But let me focus on that detail. So are you saying, and are Ukrainian officials saying, that separatists may have stolen these weapons from Ukrainian stockpiles that originated in Russia at some point?
Well, this is one of the theories, but it is not applied to the current situation because the head of the Security Service of Ukraine, Mr. Nalivaychenko, has explicitly told that the suspected anti-aircraft missile complex was taken into Ukrainian territory across Russian border yesterday at approximately 1 a.m., and then transported to the vicinity of the town of Pervomaisk. And there it was allegedly used to down the Malaysian airplane.
So it's conceivable, and again, this is just a theory, that the missile battery originated in Russia, was acquired by Ukraine, ended up in the hands of eastern Ukrainian separatists who took it across the border into Russia, Russia perhaps wanting to retake that missile because it was so dangerous, but then the separatists brought it back over the border. That's what this theory would suggest.
Well, actually, the theory suggests, and the head of the State Security Service was very positive, that the crew of the missile battery was composed of Russian servicemen. He says that it is an established fact and that Ukraine will demand from Russian authorities the surnames of these people to be made public and to be used in an investigation that the Ukrainian side launched and to which it invited international experts.
What do you make of the reports that the separatists claim possession of the flight recorders of the downed jet and the assessment from Moscow that this is some kind of a unforeseen accident or the various Russian explanations that we're hearing already?
The claim by the separatists that they have flight recorders may well be true, because today Ukrainian official spokesmen were very reluctant to speak on the matter. Another thing is that Ukrainian spokesmen say that armed separatists are intruding with the work of emergency services on the site of the tragedy. And when asked who is actually recovering the bodies and maybe the fragments of the plane, they said that they cannot confirm that those are Ukrainian emergency services workers, because as a spokesman from the Ministry for Foreign Affairs said, anyone can don a uniform.
What do you make, or what does the government say in response to Vladimir Putin's suggestion that Ukraine created the conditions for this crisis?
I haven't heard any comment on this score from the government officials, but I would say that the general public is absolutely indignant about this allegation, because even if there is, well, and we know that there is trouble in the east of Ukraine, most of people here think that it was instigated by Russia.
Andriy Kulyakov is Public Radio Ukraine correspondent. He spoke with us from Kiev. Andriy, thank you, as always.
Thank you.
To the Middle East now, it's being called a ground incursion by Israeli officials. It's being called an all-out war and invasion by the international community as the Israeli Defense Force invades Gaza late last night. Military-supplied images showed the targeting of a series of tunnels that reach from the Hamas-controlled territory into southern Israel. The goal, Israeli government spokesman Mark Regev told the Associated Press, is to see if Hamas is capable of going it alone.
Hamas today is isolated. It rejected an Egyptian ceasefire proposal that was sponsored by the Arab League and the United Nations. That same proposal was endorsed by the Palestinian government of President Mahmoud Abbas.
Spokesman for Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, that's Mark Regev speaking to the Associated Press. We're joined now by Daniel Kurtzer, former U.S. ambassador to Israel and Egypt, who's now a professor at Princeton University. Welcome back, Ambassador.
Thank you, John.
So let's talk first about this idea of Hamas going it alone. Has Israel called Hamas's bluff on some level, since Egypt is not really a part of any sort of coalition with Hamas at this point, with all these ceasefires breaking down?
Well, from a public affairs standpoint, the answer is decidedly yes. Hamas has found itself in this conflict with very few friends, maybe Qatar and Turkey, but has also seen Egypt, which traditionally was a major supporter, move much closer to Israel. In fact, having coordinated the ceasefire proposal earlier this week with the Israelis, more so than with Hamas. So the Israelis are gaining something in terms of public affairs. The question is whether they've established conditions in which they can decide when to end this conflict, and that's a big question mark.
And what would constitute an end here? I mean, this is the first intervention like this that we've seen, I believe, in 5 years. It's hard to know what a mission goal, would actually look like here.
Well, the Israelis have talked about two goals. One is to destroy as many of these tunnels as possible. In fact, the discovery of 12 or 13 infiltrators yesterday morning was probably one of the key precipitants of this ground invasion. But the second goal, which is harder to define, is to degrade Hamas's military capabilities and, quote-unquote, restore calm. So this would be a determination unilaterally by the Israeli government when it feels that calm has been restored. But there's no metric assessed or attached to it by which to measure when that's achieved.
What about the political situation? Would anything about this incursion or the situation in Gaza and how it's deteriorated loosen the hold that Hamas has on the people of Gaza politically and change the equation there?
The real question is going to be whether the maneuvering and the ceasefire can, on the one hand, bring the conflict to an end, but also empower Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority. It appears that both the Israelis and Egyptians are trying to do that by negotiating the ceasefire conditions through him. And if, in fact, he can be seen as producing that ceasefire, then his fortunes will rise as Hamas's fortunes deteriorate. After all, the real victims here are the people in Gaza who are seeing their lives destroyed and their infrastructure destroyed. And the question is whether or not they will continue to provide support to Hamas or return it to the Palestinian Authority.
We know that there's an ideological difference between Hamas and Fatah, the two factions of the Palestinian Authority here, or the Palestinian people. But you have had direct contact with Mahmoud Abbas. I'm just wondering if these are not the times for a Mahmoud Abbas, that we need a fundamentally different sort of character to unite these two people, to build this bridge, to basically take the Palestinian people forward and get rid of this division between Gaza and the West Bank Palestinians.
You know, John, the reality is Abbas is probably the best we have and that we're going to get for some time to come. He has been a constant opponent of violence to achieve Palestinian ends, and he's been a constant supporter of peace. And there aren't many in the leadership ranks of Palestinian society who can claim both of those. So I think holding out for someone else is a prescription for failure. There are some jailed Palestinians who may have some popular support, but we don't know. Some of them have been in jail for 10 years, and it's hard to know what they would do were they to be released. So in a sense, you know, you have lemons, you make lemonade. You have Mahmoud Abbas. He's proven himself in times of war and peace, and I think it's a continued time to invest in him.
What do you think he's capable of doing unilaterally that might change the game here in terms of just sort of reaching into his bag of tricks or your sense of his imagination as a diplomat and a leader?
Well, the fact is he's not capable of doing anything unilaterally. He requires steps by Israel to empower him, whether it's a freezing of settlement activity or releasing of long-term prisoners or easing up on restrictions in the West Bank. After all, Abbas runs an authority that is under occupation and derives all of its ability to produce things for its population from its relationship with Israel. So the question after the fighting ends here, and hopefully Abbas is empowered a bit by negotiating a ceasefire, is whether or not Israel will allow a relaunched peace process in which Abbas can begin to deliver some positives to the population, economic as well as social.
Beginning with a possible freeze of settlements, which is something we've talked about on this program. Daniel Kurtzer, thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
Daniel Kurtzer is former U.S. ambassador to Israel and Egypt, now a professor at Princeton University. One could easily call the entire Guantanamo Bay detention center experience an unforeseen consequence of war. The war on terror, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, the perplexing legal difficulties, both outrageous and tragic, have plagued the entire Obama administration, even though the president pledged to close Gitmo during his 2008 campaign. But this week, Pentagon officials notified Congress that they intend to transfer six Guantanamo Bay detainees to Uruguay as early as next month. They are four Syrians, a Palestinian, and a Tunisian. Their cases have been approved for transfer for 4 years, and this deal has been waiting for Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel's go-ahead since March. We turn now to Karen Greenberg, the director of the Center for National Security at Fordham Law School. Karen, welcome once again.
Thank you for having me.
So the Uruguay, why on the Uruguay and the who here? What distinguishes these detainees?
Well, the only thing that distinguishes them is that they happen to be on the list of those, the 78 that have been cleared for release that have not yet been released from Guantanamo Bay. So that's what distinguishes them. And the president has been conscientiously and deliberately whittling down this list of what began as 86 and whittling it down to whatever countries he could find. Now, the president of Uruguay has made it clear on several occasions that his disapproval of Guantanamo Bay and even of the force feedings. So one of these detainees is an individual who was involved in a court case and still is involved in a court case in the U.S. courts challenging his force feeding. And so it's possible that there is some underlying criticism to this of Guantanamo Bay, but it doesn't really matter. The bottom line is these detainees will be transferred to Uruguay, and Obama will be moving his way towards closing Guantanamo Bay.
And your mentioning of the force feeding incident means that one of these individuals was involved in the hunger strike, which resulted in the force feeding. And that was something over the last 12 months that we've been dealing with.
Yeah. And actually, we've been dealing with it since the beginning of Guantanamo. There have been periodic hunger strikes. Some of them have been reported. Some of them haven't. But last year, a hunger strike caught the attention of the world. And so this was one of the individuals that challenged it. And it's still in the courts. If the transfer goes forward, if Congress approves it within the 30-day period and the transfer goes forward, then I guess that case will be moot. There are other cases coming up through the courts that are challenging it.
Why does Congress get to veto or approve these here?
Because Congress has a 30-day approval or veto time in which to look at these transfers. That was the deal that they brokered. And it's the reason that people were so upset last month when Bergdahl was transferred immediately, secretly, without notifying Congress. I think what the president is trying to show here is that, for all intents and purposes, he intends to alert Congress, and that the Bergdahl case was a one-off that had to do with the safety of Bergdahl and the health of Bergdahl.
Are we seeing the precedent being established here for this kind of extrajudicial White House-Congress partnership in the dealing with these gray area detainees at Guantanamo? Certainly the White House doesn't want to go down this road again, but somehow we may eventually get here.
Well, yes, you're right. Guantanamo is a gray area. I don't know if I would call this extrajudicial, but yes, I think if what you're trying to say is, let's just close this deal, let's go forward as quickly as we can, and let's not litigate it so that it takes even longer, I think that's correct. There is a realistic, pragmatic approach to Guantanamo, which is, let's let these people go. One of the things that the president of Uruguay said in one of the comments that reported in the press was that the detainees were, and one in particular, the one that had been force-fed, were really broken, that they were weak and weakened from their incarceration. And I think this is a fact that should be highlighted in terms of when you're assessing their danger. These are people who have been incarcerated, often in isolation, for a very long time.
And the other takeaway here is that this really is Uruguay who's pulled the lever and decided to take them. That is really what sped this up and made it happen.
Right. And I assume there are other countries out there that may do the same following this.
Karen Greenberg, Director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law School. Thanks, as always.
Thank you for having me.
The consequence of four decades of war in Afghanistan has been the foreseen and inevitable upheaval, violence, and terrorism. It is believed that 1 million Afghans are missing today. Unforeseen by that war, though, is how this would become the basis for a hit radio program. The twice-a-week program In Search of the Missing is kind of a cross between those milk carton images of missing American kids or the light practical programming of Car Talk and the rich storytelling of This American Life. Listeners call in with stories of friends and family they cannot find, and the thousands of listeners help with tips or stories of sightings. The program is enormously popular and has reunited more than a dozen families. Joining us now is the man who has been overseeing these reunions. Akbar Ayazi is the Regional Director of Broadcasting at Radio Free Europe's Afghanistan and Pakistan Broadcast Services. Welcome, Akbar.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
What a great idea for a program. How did this get started?
Well, you know, John, for four decades, the Afghans are in war and the violence is taking place. And, you know, Afghans at once were making the largest refugee population in the world. And many Afghans are missing. As you said, over 1 million are missing. The government was not able to provide such service at the time when we started this program. We thought probably this is a great idea
that we can provide not only information to the Afghan people through Radio Free Afghanistan, and it has been a success, and we do this in both languages, Dari and Pashto. So we have two programs that we air weekly twice, and people call, and it really works, and we've been very successful in finding the loved ones, those who are missing from families and friends.
And is there a host of the program? Do you have any idea how many people listen? Are the reunions followed, you know, detail by detail, so that you can follow stories as they develop, as facts are unearthed? Or it's kind of a detective story, finding out what happened to individuals sometimes.
What we do is we get calls from listeners. They leave their telephone number and information, and also the information of those who they are searching. We put this on the air, and within days we get an answer or a call. And many times we get misled because the wrong information comes, and we try to find the person. It doesn't happen to be the same person. But throughout the years, we've been able to reunite dozens of families. I mean, I remember the emotional audio and voice that was coming from the province of Herat, reuniting a husband and a father with a family in Canada. They didn't know he was in jail for many years. The family left the message. He heard it in Western Afghanistan. He called, and we put them on the air live when they were talking to each other after 10 years. So we've had such emotional audios and sounds and moments on the air putting these families together and friends together.
Wow. Do people call as a member of a community, not necessarily expecting that their loved ones will be found, but they just call to talk, to really just talk about the circumstances, to be part of the nation?
Yeah, Radio Free Afghanistan is the part of Radio Free Europe and Liberty, the headquarters is in Prague, Czech Republic, in Europe. It's congressionally funded radio. What has happened is that Radio Free Afghanistan has taken a status of a public radio, sort of. I always call it the NPR of Afghanistan. Over 50% of the adult population listen to us on the daily basis. This is probably the largest number of any radio can have for listenership. So we have gained the trust and the credibility that we have. People trust us. They would not even trust the government or other agencies probably that work for this cause. So they call and they leave message. They hope, they trust that we will do things for them. And we have not only done projects such as finding the missing ones, but we have had many public service projects that we've put on the air, and we have received great results.
Akbar Ayazi, do you have a team of investigators that can actually take tips and follow up leads yourself, or do you have to really rely on your audience to do the investigating?
John, quite honestly, it's a two-man show, two programs run by two people, and that's all. The audience do things for us. They talk to community. They go to the mosque. They go to the village. I heard this name. I'm familiar with this name. Didn't we know such a person in this village? Or didn't we have something like this? Or didn't I meet somebody in the refugee camps? And, you know, this is how we just trace the lead, and this is how we find people and reunite them.
How close to home have these stories come to you and your family?
Not really, because fortunately I have all my family in the United States or somewhere else.
I see. But in terms of you following the program in Afghanistan, what are some of the recent successes?
The recent success was that we reunited two brothers that was in Iran. One brother was in Iran living there, and the other brother was in Afghanistan. So the brother in Afghanistan left a message because the radio is on AM frequency and it's heard in the neighboring countries. And we have a lot of listeners, Afghans living in Iran, and we just reunited them. And I hope he's traveled back home and found his brother.
Well, congratulations. And with a million people missing, Afghans missing, as a result of these decades of war, you certainly have no shortage of possible programming, at least as far as the future is concerned. No danger of being canceled.
No. This is a program that is a very popular program, and beside many other programs and public service programs that we do, this is one of the popular, and for the 10 years it has worked constantly, and we are proud of it, and we are quite happy with it, and there's no intention at all to cancel it in the near future.
Akbar Ayazi is Regional Director of Broadcasting, overseeing Radio Free Europe's Afghanistan and Pakistan broadcast services. He oversees the program In Search of the Missing. Imagine that, a popular public radio show driven by its audience. Huh, I know a show like that. The Takeaway. Let's turn to your voices now on the range of stories we've been focusing on this week. Most of you are talking about the discussion between Israel and the Palestinians and the situation in Gaza.
Well, this is Jacob from Utah. I feel like the two-state solution is kind of a dangerous one. It would be nice if it could work smoothly, but Pakistan and India have already shown that this is not necessarily a magic bullet. I have great love for Israel and hope that they can have a happy ending.
Hi, this is Chris in Louisville, Kentucky. There's a small faction of Israelis that really don't want peace. And if you look in Israel, there's quite enough folks over there that are part of the silent majority who should be speaking up to calm all this down.
Join in at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and there's much more at thetakeaway.org. A week of remarkable tragedy and conflict, and we're still right at the beginning of seeing where it's all heading. The downed Malaysian Boeing 777 civilian airliner, 298 people on board, shot down, apparently by an advanced Russian-made surface-to-air missile over eastern Ukraine near the Russian border. No survivors. This case, even as the details are still being determined, evokes the 1983 downing of a Korean Airlines flight 007 at the height of the Cold War, or the downing of an Iranian civilian plane by a U.S. Navy warship back in 1988 as the U.S. was trying to manage the flow of oil in the midst of a war between Iraq and Iran. Also, the Israelis have authorized what they are calling a major ground offensive into Gaza to confront Hamas militants after a week of cross-border rocket attacks and failed ceasefires. Joining us now, David Sanger, national security correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. David, welcome back to the program.
Good to be with you, John.
So what do you think, David? In this eerie week, are these events, the incursion in Gaza and Ukraine, are they news distractions unrelated to each other, or a sign that the whole world temperature is bubbling up all at once?
They are bubbling around the world, but I'm not sure I would necessarily say it's on a concerted level. I mean, there is an argument to be made that as the United States has pulled back from Iraq and Afghanistan and has indicated that we're not going to go into every conflict around the world, that that opens the way for separatist movements, for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, for Vladimir Putin to try new adventurism. But to some degree, many of these conflicts aren't about us. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict obviously long predates our involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan and our withdrawals. The Russian effort to show its muscles around the world here, I think, are also more to do with Putin's return as president and his feeling that Russia got the worst end of the Cold War than it does anything in the current moment. So I think the big question is, what can the United States do to moderate these forces without getting in on the ground? And that's a very hard balance.
Is it possible that the real headline in the Ukraine story is, on some level, proliferation, in that the capabilities of these long-range surface-to-air missiles are proliferating? They're in the hands of people that we would not expect to be actors, but suddenly are, and that this is a very different kind of event than, say, the Korean Airlines 007. We'll find out who actually shot this plane down, but it's a proliferation story.
It is, and I think that's important to remember because the trend over the past 20 years has been that more and more powerful weapons have fallen into the hands of non-state actors. And if you're wondering why it is that the United States is so worried about say, the spread of nuclear weapons in Pakistan and their move to smaller nuclear weapons, it's because it's not hard to imagine a separatist group in Pakistan or an extremist group getting a hold of that arsenal. And if you're looking for evidence of that, you know, when this is all done and we still don't know exactly who shot the missile that brought down the Malaysian airliner yesterday, it seems likely that we're going to discover that anti-aircraft missiles that were once in the hands of a state were overrun and put in the hands of individuals. Now, that said, they're not easy to launch, and it does raise questions about whether or not there was state help from Russia or from Russian actors who may not have been acting with the knowledge of Putin's government. We simply don't know that yet.
Although, again, thinking ahead, as you always do, does this raise the possibility of a forensics process where the international community will create rules and norms where nations that produce these kinds of weapons will be held accountable for the provenance of them, the training of individuals who end up using them, and that people like Putin and powers, even including the United States, will be held accountable?
It would be nice to think so, but so far our efforts to do that have largely failed. And think about the three areas where you try that the most. The one is in these anti-aircraft missiles. And, you know, the reason that the CIA was in Benghazi when the awful events happened there 2 years ago was to try to soak up the anti-aircraft missiles that were floating around Libya. The reason that the United States worked so hard on trying to get to nuclear forensics is so that you could hold a state responsible. But it's very difficult to imagine, John, I think, that if a nuclear weapon went off somewhere and it was ultimately traced back to ownership in some other country that lost control of it, that you would retaliate against a country that merely lost control of something. That's the difficulty. And the real area where this is hard is cyber, where it's extraordinarily difficult to figure out who a cyber attacker is, whether they're being run by the state or not.
We've talked about just a little bit earlier this hour. Is the story in Gaza possibly the fact that Israel has called Hamas's bluff? If Hamas wants to go it alone, they're going to have to go it alone without the help of Egypt and without the help of the Palestinian National Authority.
I think that is part of the story. But I think the other part of the story that worries me is it's not entirely clear how the Israelis then come back out of Gaza with the confidence that they have a permanent solution to the problem. In other words, what we've learned in Gaza is you go in, you look for these tunnels, you destroy the weapons, you come out, and you discover that Hamas gets resupplied. And so I think the hard part that I have not fully understood in the Israeli strategy is once you've gone in and done this, how do you know how to disengage? Because obviously they don't want to be in a position of permanently occupying Gaza again. They've tried that before.
So before we go, since we are talking about the week, there was this story of a drone that was possibly fired from Gaza into Israel. That story has sort of vanished in the wake of subsequent events. Does that alarm you? Have you heard anything about that? Does that change the game in any way?
Well, you know, there are a lot of drones that are in the hands now of both states and non-state actors. Most of them are not armed yet, but the Iranians have drones. The Chinese have drones. And it's only a matter of time, given the fact that the technology is not extraordinarily complex, before you'll see much more of this.
And at the end of the hour, we come back to that issue where we started, the foreseen, unforeseen consequence of proliferation of high-tech weaponry in both of these cases, in Gaza and in the downing of the Ukrainian plane. David Sanger, national security correspondent for our partner, The New York Times, thanks so much.
Thank you.
At the end of this hour and week, we want to also note the passing of Broadway actress and singer Elaine Stritch.
I'd like to propose a toast.
She was 89 years old. Her career spanned 7 decades. Elaine Stritch was a star on the big screen and small, but her real home was the stage for anyone who was lucky enough to see her there.
Here's to the ladies who lunch everybody left, lounging in their caftans and planning a brunch.
Charismatic Broadway star, but some of you younger folks may know her better as Jack Donaghy's brash and overbearing mom, Colleen, on 30 Rock.
Two women, Jack, at the same time. What are you, Italian?
I didn't choose for it to happen like this. We're ready to order now.
Just bring my son one of everything. That way he doesn't have to choose.
Comedic timing, the energy, the voice. We want to take a moment now to say goodbye to the unforgettable Elaine Stritch. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
I've interviewed Pablo Picasso and a countess named DiFrasso. I've interviewed the great Stravinsky. But my greatest achievement was the interview I had with a star who worked for Minsky.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.